Full-bodied family, my name's Kayla, and welcome back to the Full-bodied Crime Podcast. I hope you've been enjoying the episodes thus far, and I appreciate all the follows, subscriptions, likes, downloads, and reviews. You guys are truly the best, and I can't thank you all enough for the excitement you bring me. I never thought I'd enjoy doing this so much, but this podcast is super, super fun to do, and I just hope to keep bringing you guys some interesting cases that I find, and I hope you guys continue to enjoy. And don't forget, you can always email me with any feedback or cases you'd like me to cover in the future. The email account is linked on the full-bodiedcrime.com website. And that is also where you can find the sources for each case. And real fast, before I jump into anything else, I keep meaning to say this, but a huge, huge thank you to Audio Jungle for the Full-Bodied Crime Podcast theme song. I appreciate them so much, and definitely go check them out if you're looking for a theme song for your podcast or background music and any other audio-related things. They have a really amazing selection, so I just wanted to give them a shout-out really quick before we proceed. So, okay, this is an episode I had to do. I recently got accepted into a nursing program in Louisville, Kentucky. I hope I'm saying that right. So naturally, I had to do a Louisville murder since I will be calling this place home in T-6 weeks, which is crazy to me. But I'm so excited to join you guys down there. And yeah, I'm actually getting really, really excited. Completely freaking out still, but I love traveling and exploring new places, so I'm fortunate to go live in Kentucky for a year. It's a 12-month program, so I'm trying to boost my GPA so that I can apply to med school, but I also would love to learn the trade of nursing because they're such hard workers. I mean, they have one of, if not the hardest position in the hospital, and they do the most patient interactions, so I feel like through this position, I can learn really great bedside manner and all these other skills that you can pretty much only acquire through this position. So I'm really excited. And so I'll see you guys down there soon. And I need to learn how to properly say the name. Luckily, there's a YouTube video out there with the proper like verbiage, but I know Louisville is completely out. Like, I better never dare say that while I'm there. But now I'm between Louisville and Louisville, like Louisville. So I'm hoping in time I improve. I'm probably through this episode going to call it Louisville. but yeah, those are the ones I've narrowed it down to. So if I slip up, just don't mind me. I am working on it. But without further ado, let's get into today's crime. So on this episode, I'm going to be discussing the infamous Louisville, Kentucky Trinity murders. On September 29th, 1984, the town of Louisville, Kentucky would never be the same. On the September date, two men named Scott Christopher Nelson and Richard David Stevenson lost their lives in an absolute horrific tragedy. These two young men attended Trinity High School, which at the time was a Catholic, all-male school, and from my understanding, it's located in the St. Matthews region of Louisville. So this was how the case got its infamous name of the Trinity Murders, based off of the high school that both these young men attended. So the character of events that occurred on this night seemed to be an absolute wrong place, wrong time scenario. If the boys hadn't made one completely innocent yet fateful decision, they may be grown men today, and who knows where their lives may have ended up, if they'd be married, have children, even grandchildren. It's always so sad when people are taken so young, but I feel an extra sadness when they're around the age of 17, like Scott and Richard, because you're at that age in your life when it's really about to begin. You're about to turn 18, be able to live on your own, you're officially an adult now, maybe go to college. Just some of the best days of your life haven't even happened yet, so it's just extra heart-wrenching that not just one, but two 17-year-olds that were taken from Trinity High School, and they met such a terrible, terrible fate on September 29th of 1984. Now, I know Louisville is a large city, but I've heard through the grapevine that college and high school sports mean the absolute world to this town because they have no professional sports teams themselves. So this town's life revolves around their local high school sports and the big games of University of Louisville. Now, on this night in 1984, Scott and Richard were driving to their high school football game, but the game was actually an away game and not at their school. So the Trinity High football team was playing at DuPont Manual High School, I hope I'm saying that right, at their football field, which was located on East Burnett Avenue. Now, if I'm doing my Google Maps correctly and have both of the correct addresses for each high school, the two schools were only about 20 minutes away from each other. So Scott and Richard were probably thinking, oh, 20 minutes, it's no big deal, let's just get in the car and go, and we'll go and find this school. So before I get into the next part, for all you younger listeners, there was this crazy time in history when there was no Google Maps and no Waze app, and you literally had to like pull out an entire road map or follow road signs in order to reach your destinations. I have no idea how this world worked, and we're so fortunate for the technology we have nowadays, because I'm so directly incompetent that I would have been lost literally every single day of my life. So thank you, technology. But Scott and Richard didn't experience this era of technological growth, so they basically had to wing it when trying to find this school. Now, I'm unsure if they had been to DuPont previously or received directions from a friend, but the two 17-year-old men were traveling to this opposing school in hopes to cheer on their Trinity High team. Unfortunately, the two boys did get lost on their way to DuPont, and amidst some innocent conversing, I'm sure, they decided to do something along the lines of, hey, we're lost, let's go into this restaurant and ask for directions. So they stopped at the Moby Dick restaurant to ask for directions, which is obviously extremely innocent and a harmless decision, but the boys could have never known how fateful this one decision was going to be. Had they stopped at a nearby gas station? Had they just kept looking for the other high school or left their house earlier or later? They maybe would have never met the fate and absolute horror that was awaiting for them inside the Moby Dick restaurant. I also think one of the worst things about all this is that the restaurant, if I'm doing, you know, all the locations correctly, is only about 7 minutes away from the football stadium that the boys were trying to get to. So they were literally 7 minutes away from their destination when they decided to go into this Moby Dick restaurant. So Scott and Richard enter this restaurant and begin asking the workers where DuPont High School is, and if they could point them in the right direction of the football stadium. That's when two men who were dining in the restaurant offer the boys directions to the stadium in exchange for a trade. Presumably their conversation goes along the lines of, hey, we'll show you where the school is if you guys give us a ride over that way. So Scott and Richard are like, awesome, okay, here we go. These guys will guide us there and we'll drop them off where they need to go. Good deal, everybody wins. The four men get back into the vehicle and begin driving when they see the stadium. The boys are like, perfect, we can now go cheer on our high school, have fun with our friends. Awesome, thanks guys for helping us out. But then, within a moment, these men go from nice guys offering directions to two lost teens to playing a much more sinister role in their life. The two men from the restaurant demand that Scott and Richard not stop at the stadium, but stop at an abandoned parking lot behind the DuPont High School stadium. At this point, Richard and Scott knew that they had made a terrible, terrible mistake. They pulled into the parking lot, and everything after that, every horrifying moment after that, resulted in the deaths of the two Trinity High School young men. Scott and Richard were told to strip down naked and give their captors all of their personal belongings. They complied in hopes that the nightmare would just end. They were thinking that maybe if we do everything these two sadistic men ask, then we will be okay. But even though they complied with everything that these two grown men had asked them to do, the torture of that September night didn't end there. The two naked boys were bound, gagged, and one of them was sexually assaulted and sodomized, while the other had to sit there and watch, completely helpless. At this point, I'm sure the boys were sitting there in complete shock. They were right next to the football stadium where they were supposed to be. It always haunts me thinking that they probably could even hear the crowd cheering for the game, and literally they were just yards away from their stadium. They were supposed to be there cheering on their team, hanging out with their friends, watching the cheerleaders. How did this night go so wrong? After the sexual assault, they were possibly thinking that this was over. The men did what they wanted, and they will just leave them now to be found by an innocent bystander. Maybe this story will still have a positive ending. But that was not the case. Scott Nelson and Richard Stevenson were then shot execution style in the back of the head, causing the end of their lives at the young age of just 17 years old. When their bodies were found, investigators knew that they had to find the malicious murderers fast and get this killer or killers off the street. As they were trying to gather evidence, retrace Scott and Richard's steps from the evening before, and put the pieces of the puzzle together, they get a huge break in the case. Now, let's be real, most criminals aren't the smartest cookies in the cookie jar of life, but these murderers did one thing, one of the most incriminating things that could have ever been done. They began talking and bragging about the murders of Scott and Richard, and not only did one of the men brag, but he also decided to give an item of their murder victims to one of their own family members. And it wasn't just a small item, like that really couldn't be identified, but one of the murderers gave one of the victims' Trinity High School Letterman jackets to his family member. So, with this piece of evidence, the family member went to the police, and investigators knew that they had their guy. With the evidence in hand, investigators went to arrest George Wade, which further led to the identification of the second man involved in the case, Victor Taylor. While warrants were obtained and searches were conducted, investigators found additional personal belongings of both Scott and Richard in George Taylor's mother's home. The two men were then arrested and put on trial for the horrific Trinity murders. George Wade was convicted of kidnapping, robbery, and murder, and is now serving life in prison at the Kentucky State Reformatory in LaGrange, Kentucky. And Victor Taylor now sits on death row in the Kentucky State Penitentiary located in Eddyville, Kentucky. It was also later found that Victor Taylor was the one who conducted the rape on one of the victims, and he was charged for the murder of the boy, so it was not charged for the sodomization, which I'm unsure why. I think that DNA testing maybe wasn't around during this time, so maybe now that they can definitively link him to the rape, there's really no point in putting him on trial, but I'm not sure. That's just what I'm guessing, but yes, the hopes are that these two will never see the light of a free day again, and that they will live every day of their lives in agonizing pain for taking the lives of two innocent 17-year-olds back in 1984. But as we know, some criminals never really have a conscience, so who knows what they're feeling. We can only hope that they're miserable, but you guys, that is the story of the infamous Trinity murders of Louisville, Kentucky. Now, if I were to just to keep it at that for this episode, this would be a very, very short episode. So, in the spirit of excitement and wanting to find out as much as possible about the area I'll be moving to, I thought I'd do one more series of murders for you guys on this episode. So now I'll be discussing the Redhead murders. The Redhead murders weren't localized solely to Kentucky, but they were actually a string of murders that spanned across Arkansas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Kentucky. The worst part about this string of crimes is that they obviously included numerous murder victims, but the murders are still unsolved to date. So, the Redhead murders consist of a series of unsolved murders of redheaded females, which occurred between October of 1978 to the year 1992. All of these murders are assumed to be caused by the hands of one male serial killer who's remained completely unknown. The reason investigators believe this series of crimes are all related to one individual is because he had a similar signature with each victim. They were all females with reddish-colored hair, and their bodies were abandoned along major U.S. highways. Another similarity between the victims is that all the women were presumed to have been hitchhiking prior to their murders, or they were suspected to be involved with prostitution. And the reason that some of them were suspected to be involved with prostitution is because they weren't reported missing. Well, presumably they weren't reported missing. And it seemed like they didn't maybe have a strong family base, and that's why they weren't reported missing. And I guess this sometimes fits the signature of a prostitute. So, initially the serial killer was given the name of the Bible Belt Strangler due to the location of where the bodies were found, but we'll get into that in a few moments further down the road. Now, one of the complications with this case are that investigators are unsure how many victims are actually involved, and the number ranges from a possibility of 6 victims to 11 victims. Additionally, of the serial killer's suspected victims, only 4 have been definitively identified. So there are numerous Jane Does presumed to be related to this case, and some of the victims weren't even identified until November of 2018, so a little over a year ago. Mind you, these murders happened from 1978 to 1992 when I was born, and I just turned 27 in November, so that's literally the entire duration of my life that it's taken some of these females to be identified. Now, as I previously mentioned, the murders are suspected to have begun in October of 1978. The first Jane Doe related to this case was discovered on February 13th of 1983. On this date, the naked body of a Caucasian female was found along Route 250 near Littleton, West Virginia. Now, it was snowing in West Virginia at this time, and there was no snow on the ground, but no snow on the body, indicating that she was placed there fairly recently after her murder. So due to the tire tracks and footprints, it was believed that the victim was placed near the highway post-mortem. Coroners eventually discovered that she had died 2 days prior to being discovered by two passing senior citizens who thought it was just a mannequin. I can imagine that that was a very traumatic day for them. Luckily, this victim had no signs of sexual assault prior to her death, but the cause of her death was actually unable to be determined. Now, she did have auburn hair, so they suspect that this was the definitive beginning of what's now known as the Redheaded Murders, even though I said they presume that it began more like in 1978, so about 4 years before. There's really not a lot of information on anything that occurred from 1978 to when this victim was found in 1983. So the first identifiable victim was Lisa Nichols. Lisa Nichols was also known as Lisa Jarvis, and she was a 28-year-old redheaded female. She was a resident of West Virginia, but was suspected to be hitchhiking from a truck stop near Interstate 40 in West Memphis, Arkansas, when she was picked up by this unknown serial killer driving his truck. Lisa's body was found on September 16th, 1984, off of Interstate 40, and she was found only wearing a sweater, with her cause of death being strangulation. Her body was identified 9 months after her death, and luckily they were able to identify it through fingerprint testing. So about 4 months later, the suspected serial killer struck again near Jellico, Tennessee, when the decomposing body of Tina Farmer was found. Tina Farmer was just 21 or 22 at the time of her death, and on January 1st, the first day of the new 1985 year, Tina was found deceased down an embankment on the southbound side of Interstate 75. Her cause of death was similar to that of Lisa Nichols, as Tina was also strangled. However, Tina was not undressed. She was found fully clothed in a tan pullover, a shirt, and jeans. She was additionally wrapped in a blanket, which did have seminal fluid on it, indicating a sexual assault had occurred. Now, a horrific detail related to this crime was that Tina Farmer was actually 10 to 12 weeks pregnant at the time of her death. Due to the decomposed state of Tina's body, investigators presumed that she had died about 72 hours before her body was found. Now, this decomposition made it difficult to immediately identify the body, and her body wasn't actually positively identified until September 6th of 2018, which was literally just 2.5 years ago, which is insane. She was identified using fingerprint techniques, and with this new ID, investigators were not only able to confirm that she was in fact Tina Farmer, but they also put the pieces together of the last time she was seen alive. Somehow, they gathered witnesses from back in late 1984, and they suspect that Tina was actually in Indianapolis, Indiana, when she was picked up by a truck driver who said he was headed to Kentucky. Tina was a mother, a daughter, and a friend, and her life was taken much too soon at the hands of what investigators believed was a serial killer targeting these redheaded women. Tina had a family and was loved. Her family reported her missing, but it wasn't a law to put local missing persons in a national database during the time of her disappearance, so she was never linked as a victim to the crime until decades and decades later. Now, to continue the suspicious series of murders, we're now brought to Jane Doe that was murdered in Cheatham County, Tennessee. I am probably butchering that name, but so on March 31st, 1985, there was a body of a redheaded female discovered in Pleasant View, Tennessee. Now, this victim was suspected to have died 3 to 5 months before her remains were discovered, and she was allegedly between the ages of 31 and 40 at the time of her death. She was found fully clothed, and her death was due to unknown causes. Now, they believe her death is related to the redheaded murders because she was redheaded, and her remains were discovered off of Interstate 24 in between the 29 and 30 mile markers. Shortly after, literally just a few days later, on April 1st of 1985, another body was found in possible relation to the string of redheaded murders. Now, this case was a bit different, I will say, because the victim was found in a large white refrigerator. Her body was stuffed into this refrigerator outside of the town of Gray, Kentucky, and her body was discovered completely naked aside from two pairs of socks and two pendants that were attached to a gold chain. These pendants were that of a gold heart and eagle. Now, Gray was a completely safe and quiet town, so something like this was completely out of the ordinary for this part of Kentucky. 500 individuals from Gray attended this woman's funeral, and at the time of her death and funeral, she was a complete Jane Doe, so they went to show their respects to someone they completely had no idea who it was, and they didn't know her, which is super amazing and just shows the care and compassion that the people of Gray had for the individuals in their community. It was later determined through DNA testing in October of 2018, so again, decades and decades after the murder, that this Jane Doe was Epsie Regina Pilgrim. Her DNA was matched through her grown daughter, who said her mother went missing when she was just 6 weeks old. Epsie also had four other children and was a loved mother. Being that she had red hair, her murder is suspected to be linked to the redheaded murders, even though she was found in a refrigerator, and the refrigerator and her remains were found off of Route 25 in Gray, Kentucky, so it is highly suspected that she is a victim of this unknown serial killer because of her hair color and because of where she was found off of the major route, I guess you would say. I don't know if routes are major, but Route 25, which is well known in that area, but the only difference is that she was found in a refrigerator. Now, Epsie was local to Western North Carolina, but investigators were informed that she may have been attempting to get a ride through the trucker's CB radio and was possibly picked up by a truck driver. So now we're at April 3rd, 1985, so literally 2 days later. Now the skeletonized remains of a young woman were found about 200 yards off of Big Wheel Gap Road. This victim was believed to have been between the ages of 9 to 15 at the time of her murder, and to have been dead about 1 to 4 years by the time she was found. Which, these numbers are, like, super kind of vague. I feel like that's kind of a broad age, 9 to 15 and 1 to 4 years. But this made it very difficult to identify this victim because everything is so, like, somewhat vague, if you will, but another reason they believe this victim could be linked to the serial killer involved with the redheaded murders is because this Jane Doe's body was found only 4 miles away from Jellicoe, Tennessee, where the body of Tina Farmer was discovered. So from there, the murders just continually get worse and worse. On April 14th, 1985, the body of a young female between the ages of 14 to 20 was found in Greenville, Tennessee, and this victim was presumed to have been killed anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks before her body was found, with her cause of death being severe blunt force trauma to her head. Additionally, investigators determined that she may have also been stabbed, but due to her decomposed state, they were unable to definitively determine if stabbing had contributed to her premature death. Similar to Tina Farmer, this Jane Doe was found to be pregnant, to be about 6 to 8 weeks into her pregnancy, but she did miscarry, and she did have the miscarriage right before her murder. So this Jane Doe had light brown hair to blonde hair with red highlights, so this is why investigators are suspecting that she fell victim to the redhead murder serial killer. Now, luckily, investigators were able to obtain DNA back in 1985, of this specific Jane Doe, and she was identified in November of 2018 as 17-year-old Elizabeth Monette. Lamotte. Oh my goodness, I butcher these names so bad. Lamotte? L-A-M-O-T-T-E. Her DNA was obtained by New Hampshire police in 2017, and results were concluded that the victim was Elizabeth. She had been staying in a group home in New Hampshire at the time of her death, and she'd gained a furlough day, but she had never returned home to her family, so they knew something was terribly wrong. Now, before I conclude the information on this particular serial killer, or suspected serial killer, I do want to touch back on some details from one of the cases. So there was a woman named Linda Shackey, S-H-A-C-K-E, that was basically supposed to be another victim of a terrible murder, but somehow she miraculously survived her attack. Linda was another redheaded woman who was picked up in Knox County, Tennessee. Amidst her ride, there was a huge shift into a nightmare, and Linda was soon attacked by this man who had picked her up. She was bound, strangled, and dumped alongside Interstate 40. Before she was dumped, Linda had been choked by a piece of cloth that was ripped off of her t-shirt. She was then bound and left for dead on the side of the road in a storm drain. She was later found and survived the incident, which is absolutely amazing to me. But in 1987, a man named Jerry Leon Johns was convicted of the kidnapping and assault of Linda. And in 2019, so just last year, DNA evidence linked him to the murder of Tina Farmer, who was the victim that died in December of 1984. And Linda's attack had only occurred 2 months after Tina's death. Mind you, the redhead murders were suspected to go all the way back, or all the way into 1992, although I couldn't find any cases past the ones I've discussed, but Jerry Leon Johns was in prison, like, in 1987, so he wouldn't have been able to conduct any murders or attacks after this date, and so that is a little bit contradicting, but I do feel like he's a little more involved. But unfortunately, Jerry Leon Johns died in prison in 2015, so investigators were never able to question him about his possible involvement in any of the other redhead murder cases. But, like I said, I'm a little suspicious that he may have a few more victims than the two redheads that we know about, being Linda and Tina. So, another little thing I said that I would touch back on the Bible Belt Strangler part. In 2018, students enrolled in a sociology class at Elizabethton High School, and they studied this case with their instructor, and this is where they got the term the Bible Belt Strangler. They determined that the information from the FBI profile and everything else that they gathered, this would be his new title, and they described him as this because they believe he's a white male born between 1936 and 1962, so he would have been between 23 and 49 in the 1984-1985 time period when these murders occur. And he was likely a commercial trucker frequenting Interstate 40. And they estimated his height and weight to be about 5'9 to 6'2 and weigh 180 to 270 pounds. And they said his work was likely based in or around the city of Knoxville, Tennessee. It's kind of vague on why he got the Bible Belt name, but anyway, that's where they came up with the name. But y'all, that is what I have for you on this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. And please don't forget to give me a review on Apple Podcasts. And check out the Instagram FB_crime podcast for the pictures related to this case. And check out the Twitter @FullBodiedCrime and our Facebook page, Full Body Crime, for all the updates regarding this podcast. That's when I talk about new episodes being released. And so on and so forth. Lastly, go and check out the website, full-bodycrime.com, for all sources related to this case. And just know I adore you all, and thank you so much for tuning in, and have a beautiful and blessed day. Bye-bye.